Welcome to Term 1, Session 5. This is Shem Shabir, a schus for a full shlema for Leah Bas Sara. Please God. Welcome. Just brilliant. Just made it. Thank you very much, Family Beagle, for hosting. Very, very, very good. Short notice as well. Thank you very, very much. Last time, we finished the first parak. And instead of just jumping straight into the second parak, there's a couple of things I wanted to do with you, especially the concept of tarot cards. Tarot cards are very, very common. And it's in the Goy Shavelt. There's lots and lots of tarot readings and cards and people that hold a tremendous amount into the koyach of the tarot. And they're very careful when they open them and close the deck, and what they keep in black silk and has to be kept away from moonlight and all this business. And they deal out the tarot cards, and based upon the turning over the tarot cards, they procrastinate the future. They say, this is going to happen to you, and this isn't going to happen to you, and this is what's happening. And they take a lot of reality. They really hold of it very, very strong as a thing. So it's discussed in here, these kinds of things, not just tarot, these kinds of things are discussed in here. At the end, in another way of understanding from the Alshach and the Malbim. So I just wanted to go over with it because it's so much work on it anyway, and I looked it up, I thought it would be really interesting, but it could be that I'm just doing it basically because there's so much work on it, and it's really not interesting to you at all. But the problem is I'm giving the shiur, and because it's interesting to me, I tend to bore you with things that interest me. That's anyone listening into this will know this by now. If you've heard what I do, I'm sorry about that. But this is what we're going to do. Now, we said from last time, what are we talking about from last time? We finished off on Lamed Beis and Lamed Gimel, on Lamed Beis. So we did that. We said it for the folly. We did do Lamed Gimel. We got all the way to Lamed Gimel.
Yeah.
We did it. Brilliant. So we did Lamed Gimel, and we were talking about the cause of calamity. Let them eat from the fruit of their sin. Yeah, and we if that's what they're going to do, let them eat from the fruit of their sin. And we said that if an individual goes down the route, despite all the best advice they've got, and they know what they're doing, when they do cry out, Hashem won't answer them. He won't answer them because they're not crying out sincerely; they're just crying out in pain. And if someone just cries out in pain, I'm not going to answer them. And then we had this whole argument at the end. What about Mitzrayim? What about Mitzrayim? In Mitzrayim, people cried out just in pain, and Hashem answered them even though they weren't doing tshuva. They were crying out in pain. And Hashem said, right, I've heard the groaning of my children. I'm taking them out of Mitzrayim. So why can't I just cry out in pain and Hashem answer me? Remember this? So what do we say? That's right. What we said was, cooking on gas tonight. I can say, we know what we're on about. What do we say? We said in that stage, it was different. This was pre-Matan Torah. They didn't have anything to return to. You can't say, you learnt the Torah, you knew what the mitzvahs were, you were keeping the mitzvahs, then you went off the mitzvahs, like in the Bais Rish and Bais Sheni, where Kodesh Baruch Hu gave you a clap and said, what are you doing? This is ridiculous. And then they know what they were doing, and they're going back to the hot, lofty levels of Bais Rish and Bais Sheni. That wasn't what's happening in Mitzrayim. They didn't have anything. They were just crying out in pain. And so I said, right, fine. I've seen how much pain they're in. I'm going to take them out and give them the Torah. Right? Now that you know what you're doing and you've lived with Torah, you understand the Torah, then you decide to just throw it in the bin, and then calamity comes your way. Don't expect me to pull you out of that when you're suffering. But I'll always respond to you if it's a true tshuva. If you're crying out because you want to come back to Torah and mitzvahs, the door's always open. But if you're crying out just because things are hard, well, you got yourself, you made your bed lying. Remember we said that? You got yourself into the situation. You rejected me. You reject me. That comes with a price, right? Notice in Vidui on Yom Kippur, I think I've quoted Vidui quite a few times now. In Vidui on Yom Kippur, we clap Al Chait. One of the Al Chait that we clap is Kshinu Oref, that we were stiff-necked. And I'm not talking from a physiotherapy point of view. I mean stubborn. Why is stiff-necked considered stubborn, by the way? If someone's stiff-necked, Moshe Rabbeinu called us Amkshay Oref, he says, you're a stiff-necked people. What does, for that basis, some people say that's very, very complimentary. Very, very complimentary, because people are going to make a whole mockery of the way that you live and all the mitzvahs, how silly they seem to you. You're going to keep them nonetheless. It's good to be stubborn for its mitzvahs. It's very, very good. We need to be a stubborn people because you're stubborn keeping Shabbos. So I says, what a load of it, can't use your smartphone on Shabbos? No, what an idiot. You go, well, I'm stubbornly keeping to it, right? You need a bit of stubbornness. It's not bad to be an achshon. But he did also say in a criticizing manner, why is being stiff-necked linked to stubborn? What stubborn has got to do with your neck? Say you're a stiff-legged people. What stubborn has got to do with neck?
I'm willing to turn to another thing.
My ankles are stiff. I also don't want to turn.
It connects your
body
to your heart.
Oh, that's very mystical. That's to do with the head. So, very good. I like that mystical set of people. That's very good. The idea of Amkshay Oref is that the head is generally what turns around to look behind you. When someone says, look behind you, you don't turn your ankles. you generally turn your neck. Very, very straightforward, no mysticism required. So someone says, look over there, you know, look what you've been through. You go, oh yeah, that's quite a lot. Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to say, you're stiff-necked, you haven't turned around to see just how much HaKadosh Baruch Hu has done for you. How can you keep the golden calf and keep that going? Well, I've got news for you, it's a year of muckus, a year of plagues in Eretz Yisrael. Then you cross the river, remember that? That's all the waters, but it's pretty amazing. Then you go to the Torah, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed you that. Have you forgotten where you've come from? And all the promises to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov that are now being fulfilled? Can you not just see what you've been through? You're being stiff-necked. Look behind you and see what got you to this point, right? That's the concept. Ah, so we've been obstinate. When we say that I'm Kshei Orif, it means we've been obstinate and stubborn. Why is that a sin? Why is that a sin? It's not wrong in and of itself to be stubborn. Stubbornness is not a sin. There's no sin of stubbornness. Stubbornness, same with depression, by the way. There's no sin in being depressed, but it's the worst state to be in, says the Rambam, because all sins can come out of depression. Once you're truly depressed, everything's, yeah, I'll do anything. Once you're depressed, you've given up on yourself. You know what I'm saying? So too, there's nothing wrong with being stubborn, but what does that stubborn mean? You've been obstinate in that what? And this is the key point, and I would write this down because it's really important for Yom Kippur, just in case you're making any notes. You've attributed difficulties in your life to chance rather than Hashem sending you a message. Now that's a problem. Being stubborn in and of itself is not a problem. You want to be stubborn? Be stubborn for Torah and mitzvahs, but fuck a shah. But when you're stubborn in the fact that Hashem tells you, I am shaking up the boat here in the very same way that you've rebelled against me, and you stubbornly refuse to see the calling card from Hashem, and you just turn it around and say, I don't care. I don't care about it. Oh, that's Kshei Orif. That is stiff-necked. You've got to realize, you've got to be malleable enough to realize that when I'm sending you messages, pick up the best. If a HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends you a business card, you can't overlook that and say that's a chance random event. It's a random coincidence. That's called Hashkacha. We learn about this in the concept of Hashkacha, going back and forth into Hashem, the whole second parak. It's all about the idea of Hashem's interface. You can't turn around and say the entire Hashkacha system is just chance. That's very stubborn. So God then says, in that particular way, then you eat the fruit of your way. If that's how you want to see me, you can eat your casualness. You can eat your chanceness. And you can say your whole life is essentially an outcome of chance. Says the Gemara, that if a guy goes and gets his stars read, you go and get, I'm not talking about what's in the back of the Daily Mail. It's not, today's a fantastic day for you to make an investment. Oh, for goodness sake. So I just, you know, like whatever's going into the head is really that. But you go to like a professional astrologer, and there are such people, they're very complicated. They make a whole chart and they find out which planets are ascending and where the moon is, etc., etc. And they base that upon their tradition. It's a very complicated report that they get. The punishment is whatever they say is whatever you get, even if it's beneficial. If you feel as if that's what's guiding you, God will allow you to walk down that path and make it look as if that's what's guiding you. Interesting concept, no? That's the punishment. Their punishment is a result of their own way, which is to attribute misfortunes to chance, to the stars. Then that's what you get. And don't think that that punishment will atone for any earlier sins. This punishment is a standalone concept of you deciding that you're going to just go and get a star chart, and whatever the star chart says, that's what it's going to do. Then fine, then I'll fix you to that and you won't be able to break out of it. If that's how you hold, and you hold that the stars aren't just my servants, and you'll be on the stars, then you can jolly well keep them. Yeah, but it says everything's going to go good, but fuck a shop. Then you'll realise when it goes good, it's only from the stars. It's because Mars is ascending in the house of Venus. That's why it's going good. Yeah, that's a problem, because after that you'll think, well, everything's like that, and like, there's no Shkocha Protus at all. There's no interface between the Kodesh Baruch Hu and me and myself at all. That's a terrible outcome, because it kind of cements you into this feeling of distance from Hashem, which is the absolute antithesis of what the Torah is about. The Torah is about developing an incredibly close, intimate relationship with Hashem, where you feel as if you're on a really, really close kind of leveling kind of relationship with Him, where He's interfacing with you and you're interfacing with Him. But if you're just dumping it and being stubborn to say whatever's happening in the stars, then b'vakasha, then you eat the fruit of your own way. Don't call out to me. Call out to your stars. So far, so good. Let's talk about the tarot. Okay, the first known deck of tarot that's ever been found was attributed to the year 1440. 1440. It goes back quite a way, doesn't it? 1440 is a long way. And it's believed they were originally created as a game for nobility in that time. It was kind of like top trumps. Okay, it was top trumps for nobility. And that's what they were using, right? Now, the first ever account of divination through tarot cards is attributed to a cartomancer called Jean-Baptiste Alliette in 1770. Now, that's what he was saying. He was using the same pack of tarot, but he started using it to, like, read your tea leaves. Do you know what I'm, you know what I'm saying? Now, a decade later, there was a man called Antoine Court de Gobelin, and he said the cards were a key to a lost Egyptian magical wisdom written by the Egyptian god who was inspired with written knowledge. It was the god of written knowledge, okay? And that's what he used to say. And he went around and he tried to sell the cards, saying it was an ancient Egyptian thing. Now, in 1799, which wasn't much later, they found the Rosetta Stone, which essentially was a stone which translated the hieroglyphs to Greek. And we know what Greek is, so we used it as a reverse dictionary to be able to decipher all the hieroglyphs. And it allowed us to understand ancient Egyptian, hence the concept of Rosetta Stone. Oh, that would get right. Nowhere in the Rosetta Stone did it support the idea that these cards came anything from this particular god of written knowledge. It's all a load of nonsense invented by Antoine Court de Gobelin. So far, so good. That's been blown apart now from 1440 to 1799. So far, so good. Yeah? Okay. Nevertheless, a theory attributed the tarot to the wandering Romani or gypsies because they say that they're actually descendants of the ancient Egyptians and they carried the decks on their travels through Europe. And that's why a lot of the time you see Gypsy Rose Lee who'll give you a tarot reading or look into a crystal ball and read your future. Often when you go to fairs or fates, there'll be Gypsy Rose Lee, there'll be a gypsy or something. And it's those gypsies, because they say, we came from ancient Egypt and we've inherited all these concepts. Okay. Now, in the 19th century, there was an occultist called Eliphas Levi. Now, really, that was a French non-Jew who changed his name to Levi, but his name was really Alphonse Louis Constant. And he changed his name to Levi because he wanted to be considered Jewish. Because then he started saying the tarot is actually rooted in the Kabbalah. And he said that the tarot originated in Eretz Yisrael and contained the wisdom of the Kabbalah. And he legitimized the tarot for many magical and esoteric groups around Europe who they accepted the Kabbalah as a timeless wisdom. And they said, well, if he can link this to the Kabbalah, we hold that the Kabbalah is real. And they said, essentially, the tarot was a mystical Jewish tradition. That's why you'll sometimes say the Jews invented the tarot. That's not true. That was Alphonse Louis Constant, Eliphas Levi's, whole thing to sell more packs. That's actually, that you really, because if you can make it.
Jewish concept.
That's, yeah, selling more packs is a Jewish concept. But saying the pack, yeah, of course, wholesale, if you can, wholesale, right? That's a very good idea. Now, the tarot has absolutely no source in the Kabbalah. And the tarot is included in the prohibition against divination in the Torah. However, it is interesting to note that using the Kabbalah to legitimize and popularize trendy spiritualism is no new phenomena. You can just ask all the pop stars and Madonna and people like that in Hollywood, go to the Kabbalah Center. Yeah, you want to do something, just add the word Kabbalah to it, and it's really cool and it's really deep because there is something called the Kabbalah, but you know, it's not available in like pop kind of like, it just doesn't work like that. Now, it's very highly unlikely that anyone nowadays has the ability to use magic or witchcraft to reveal secrets or predict the future. But that's particularly so with the tarot, because this practice just popped up and has no rooting whatsoever in any form of, it's nothing more than a card game. I would essentially see it as a pack of top trumps for the future. So basically, it's like playing top trumps. It's absolute, complete nonsense. And it's been set up like that. We do know historically that it's nonsense. But these things where people will lay out the cards and give tremendous kayach, you should know it's poshut, utterly empty. However, if a Jew were to go to a tarot reading and believe what the tarot would say, you can keep it. The fact that it's empty meaninglessness is irrelevant. What's irrelevant is that you've given empty meaninglessness meaning. Mm-hmm. And Hashem says, if you do that, you can have what it tells you. And if that leads you to crying out to me, don't think I'm going to come and get you back on that. You decided to turn to their pack of top trumps to find out what's going on with you instead of turning to me and my Tyra. Then you can keep the top trumps. You can also top trumps to get you out of it. You know what I'm saying?
Is it the same as the lines on your hand and all these?
Well, there is a Kabbalistic tradition to the lines of the hand, but the way that it's being given over into the Goy Shevelt is not the same, but there's a very deep tradition as the lines on your hand and also the lines on the face. Indeed. I'm going off.
1 second. So the cards, if somebody reads the cards, that's just for fun, not for genuine, but they're still included in this.
I would tell you not to do that. Even for fun.
Okay.
I would tell you that you're dealing with stuff which has been now set aside essentially for divination, which is us. That's like saying, just for fun, we're making a bacon sandwich just to see what it would look like or something. You're dealing with something which is intrinsically osa now. You're right. That's just, it's ridiculous. I hold of nothing by them. But people now use them. Right. At the end of the day, people are using them to use this in this way. They're not using them as a pack of top trumps. Right, it's like, you know, maybe I'll tell you what you could do. As a Rav, maybe you could see what's going on so you could derive, you can learn what it isn't. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Samach Gimel Omad Aleph, that says that there was one of the Rabbonim that used to do Kishuf in front of the base of Medrash just to show you how disgusting it is. And he was protected from its negative effects. He was only doing Aus Limud Torah. So if you're giving it in a shir to say, this guy thinks this means this, and this guy thinks that, then people think, oh, that's ridiculous. Then if you're doing it like that, then efshir, you could deal with this kind of thing. But otherwise, if you're just dealing it out to see what it would look like, I'd just say, leave it alone. Oh, not because it has any meaning, but now it's been set aside for things that people want to do treif with. It's just a tool of silliness. Essentially, it's a tool of silliness. Yeah, I was going to tell you about the lines on the face, but yes, Ms. Lazar. God, no, you ask a question and I'll do the lines of the face thingy.
Just really quickly, so you said that if we attach meaning to these silly things, they will stick with us.
Mm.
What about if we attach meaning to what some people very much believe in and other people think are silly, like Sugulas? If you do this and you attach...
Yeah, you've got to be careful. Okay, I remember speaking to Aaron Feldman, who was giving a shiur in Mishlei, Moti Shabbos, which I attended, packed shiur, and he was doing that for 20 plus years before he went to Nesron in Baltimore. And he obviously there's a massive discussion because there's some segulas which are brought down that are very, very clear. However, I did have a Rav who personally told me that he went through a phase in his life of doing segulas. And someone would phone him up and say, there's a segula going on, and he would literally put down the phone and run to do. I'm not knocking the koyach of segulas. There is such a thing. We know that a stone, a ruby, with a woman who's about to go into labor, is definitely a concept because it's Shevet Reuven, it's got the ruby, he was a full-term baby. There's all these kinds of things. It's not so much a segula, it's almost like kind of like a mechanical concept that's brought down from the Torah. Also that a woman is in such labor because she kept the ruby. I've heard many stories of women that kept the ruby too long, they have to take the ruby away because otherwise, there's all these things. We do know the Mishnah talks about women, people who can't sleep, regarding the tooth of a fox, tooth of a live fox or a dead fox, for people that have got insomnia or people that are overly sleepy. We do know those things work. Indeed, I have a friend that actually had access to a fox's skull, and his Rebbe's wife couldn't sleep, and they did the thing, and it mamish worked 100%. That's not so much a segula, that's a mechanic. But there are actual segulas, like red strings. Red strings are a segula. You tie a red string around Kevar Rochel 7 times, and you say 7 pesukim 7 times, then it gives like a certain koyach to the red string, yada, yada, yada. It's like this. Rav Aaron Feldman said to me, and in front of about 100 people like this, said to me, there is a Jewish segula which we know absolutely works. And that's tefillah.
Yeah.
Okay? Tefillah is the ultimate Jewish segula. And it actually genuinely works. And he says that's not to knock things that are brought in the Sfarim and things like that. But we do have to make sure that... You should do it under the guidance of a spiritual mentor as to how you utilize segulas. I'm not knocking them, but you shouldn't rely on segulas as your reliance. You can put a segula in here and there, but your real segula is your relationship to the Borei Olam. That's what makes us so special. That's the segula of being part of Knesset Yisrael. We've got Baruch Hashem, direct line. We've got the monopoly. So that's more important. And I'm not knocking the depth of belief and the truism behind many of these things. But I do remember a friend of mine who was my age, contemporary my age. He was from New Zealand. And he got engaged to a Sephardi girl in Eretz Yisrael. And the family were nothing short of superstitious. They were a very traditional family. They were a pretty learned family. And he once went over to their house And he fell asleep. He fell asleep on the couch. He was engaged to this girl. He fell asleep on the couch. And he woke up and he noticed that his to-be mother-in-law was sprinkling salt all over him. Because it was segula, against iron horror. She had a belief that it was against iron horror. So he woke up and he immediately asked, "Are you trying to cook me?" Like, you know, if you want to put tomato sauce everywhere, you know, I'm quite good with garlic. You know, so yeah, you got to, you know, that's, you know, we don't, that's, there's certain things we do. Again, you get your relationship and you're working on a higher, that we do in the standard methodologies. Going to Zagula, as you ask a spiritual mentor in a particular private case, what should I do this? Yes, sometimes there is a Zagula to do certain things. Sometimes there is. And sometimes they do and they do. I know, like, for a woman who's expecting and the baby's breech, there's such a Zagula to have water spat in your face from a spring and things like that, from an open spring, from Buxton. People go to Buxton and there are all these things. Some people say it works. Some people, I know for a fact, some people say it doesn't. Many people have told me it doesn't work. So again, how much, again, tefillah is the ultimate thing. Tefillah is the ultimate thing. Do people say, go in your house and check if any sforim are upside down. Yeah. Find something's upside down. Such an idea. But don't put all your faith on the sefer being the right way up. There's sometimes a case that a Kodesh Baruch Hu wants a breech baby, you know what I'm talking about? And a segula won't undo it. I'm not knocking the depth of belief and trust that you put in it, but I think what you have to do is reassess the level of depth and trust
right.
you put in it.
Say, like you said about the tarot cards, you want to believe in it, that's what you'll get. He doesn't say the same about Segula. That's what you're doing, that's what you're
right,
doing.
No, because sometimes a person approaches Segula almost like a Mishagas. And a Mishagas isn't anything. There's no Chazaka on a Mishagas. But if you're going to, there is such a thing in reading the stars. There is a tradition in reading the stars. If you feel as if that's where your fortune and your future lies, then you can go with your stars, yeah? That's why I'm talking about things like tarot. Just stay away. It's not necessary. It's not necessary because really, if you really want to know what your future is, you carve it out by your own tshuva and Torah mitzvahs. It changes everything. Tshuva, tefillah, tzedakah, ma'ariv, rasa, gezerah. Your whole life can be changed from the moment of tshuva, from Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. We know that as our tradition. So yes, we could. There are people in Judaism who do star charts, chachomim in Eretz Yisrael. Their star charts, especially given the moment of your birth, they'll be uncannily correct about your personality and reveal things that you have never told anyone. I mean, it's impossible that they would know that any other way. The only reason you can do that is to find out your own midas so that you can know how you can better serve Hashem. For instance, if an individual is a big gvir, I know a big gvir that went there and he read on his star chart, he says, you're extraordinarily stingy. Extraordinarily. And the guru is one of the biggest gvir. And he went there and he said, you're right. And he goes, every time you give tzedakah, you must be struggling with yourself to give the tzedakah because you're so stingy. Because I've never told anyone that in my whole life. He says, that's what you have to overcome. You've been sent here to overcome that miserliness. Right? So that you can do. Not what's going to happen in my future. What should I do? Who should I marry? Where should I go? But rather, like, what are my tools that I've been given in order to be able to close to Shem? In those particular cases, it's a permitted concept. Okay. Now, then we were finishing off this idea, and we were saying that also these psukim can be talking to all Klal Yisrael, not only to the individual that's got themselves into the particular situation, but if Knesset Yisrael rebel against Hashem, even if they're crying out in woe underneath their oppressors, if they're not crying out in yearning to come to Hashem, and Hashem can discern why people are crying out, then he's still not going to answer you, he'll leave you to your oppressors. That's what Solomon is saying at the end of the first parak, and that concludes the first parak with everything, including the whole shtick on tarot. Yeah, is that okay? Yeah. All right, let's do an intro to the theme of the second parak. Always like to do a theme to the second parak. Now, in this parak, Shlomo is teaching us that a Kodesh Baruch Hu will grant wisdom to those who deserve it and desire it, and he won't grant it to people that don't. That's key. Now, if you get such wisdom, this perek teaches that it will save you from evil and from evildoers. There's a tremendous segula, dare I say it, to having chokhmah. If a Kodesh Baruch Hu gives you part of his chokhmah, it will protect you in this world and the next. And long term, even though the wicked may be seen to prevail in this world, definitely guaranteed your money back when all things go back to like square one with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, the wicked are going to fall and the upright will be rewarded. We're going to ask why they aren't rewarded earlier. He's going to discuss this. Now, we're being told, we'll see in the first two psukim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu considers his children as his son, like we're his children, we're his like firstborn sons. And that means that his mitzvahs and toiling in his Torah brings you to the level of being considered one of Hashem's children. Rashi brings the idea that you should pray to Hashem for success in your learning and your mitzvahs, and especially in your Yerushalayim. You may turn around and say, excuse me, but my Yerushalayim, Kol B'Day Shemayim, Rak Yerushalayim, right? Everything is in Hashem's hands, except for your level of fear of heaven, right? So in which case, fear of heaven is completely down to you. How can you daven for Yerushalayim if Yerushalayim has got nothing to do with Hashem? The answer is he can help you on your path for you to go and get it. He can open doors to make things easy. That's also, I think we discussed, how can you daven for someone else to do tshuva? Remember that? You can daven for people to do. You can't obviously daven that their will is overruled and they just start keeping mitzvahs, but you can daven that they meet the right person, do the right thing, end up seeing the right book at the right time that will inspire them. That's Atah D'Shema, that you can do. A Torah is meaningful and eternal. Even through its study, Hashem, though, grants humans, while they're alive in this world, a moral compass and the ability to make very powerful decisions. That's a big theme in this perek. And another concept is that a genuine love of Torah protects you against less desirable influences in the world. And he'll discuss these desirable influences as a strange woman, which all this does not, remember, it's a marshal, we're not talking about strange women. Okay, we're not, oh, I know a strange woman, isn't she? She lives down the road, she's very odd. That's not what I'm talking about. It means a strange woman is a desire which is external from the Torah. And it also represents our internal rebellious immaturity. Remember we talked about Admasai. Hashem kind of like, is it how long are you going to behave immaturely? Because we immaturely always strive to declare our independence of Hashem and that we're in charge. And that's an immaturity which gets busted, as it were, once you accept the idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's in charge, and you're going to do that through Torah. Okay? Now, there's a beautiful Rabbeinu Yonah that I saw on the first two Pesukim, so I thought I'd give you. So the first two Pesukim say, for the understanding of your heart, you should turn your ear and listen to wisdom. Let your voice be given to understanding and call to wisdom. I'll go through it when I go them again, though, but I want to give you the Rabbeinu Yonah. So Shlomo HaMelech is setting out a tried and tested method. Rabbeinu Yonah says that there are 48 kinyonim ha-Torah, there are 48 things to do. It's brought in the Mishnah in Kedushin as to how to get Torah. But the most important thing you have to do to get limited Torah and to understand Torah is to learn it. You're going to have to open your ear to listen to the wisdom of Torah. There's no tricks. There's no gimmicks. And I remember there was a course in Jerusalem while I was there that was done by a Kiruv outreach organization, which used to pay people to turn up to share. If you turned up, they'd give you like a 50 shekel stipend for every shear. That's that obviously someone donated it, that every time every person turned up, they got 50 shekelim as they walked in the door to sit up. That sounds very nice. That's a nice way. I'm telling you, a signing on gift is a gimmick, and long term, it doesn't lead to hardcore Torah. The only thing that does that is your ability to actually acquire it. Actually learning it, especially from teachers and rebbeim, is the method to acquire Torah. But as the pasuk continues, that's not enough. You have to turn your heart to understand. Remember last week I said, I may be a professional teacher, but you've got to be a professional student. You've got to say, it's my job to glean and skim Torah ideas wherever I'm going. You've got to be active in that. And part and parcel of that is curtailing your obsessions of materialism and your heart's desires. You've got to set aside time to say, I want to make the Torah a serious impact, not just an intellectual quest. It used to be in the war, by World War II, there were groups of individuals who were very kind of Sigmund Freudian and Jungian. They would sit and learn Gemara on Shabbos for the intellectual challenge of it while they smoked cigars in smoking jackets. So they would discuss a Gemara in Bava Basra and talk about the Eifa Torah arguments and things like that while they were smoking on Shabbos, right? The idea is they approach Torah purely as an intellectual concept. Now in Korea, in the schools, they teach Gemara. You're aware of this, right? I think I've told you this. They learn Gemara in school. The ambassador to Korea many years ago came to Israel and asked why you're so smart. And someone quipped, they all learn Gemara. And he took that very seriously. He found out what that was and he found it. And they now print the Gemara in Korean, not according to the way that we print it on the diverse, but the actual Gemara. And they learn it in grade school. They're tested in it. The idea being that it sharpens the mind and they want to be smart. They want to be smart. The Jews are smart. What's making them smart? They want, so we'll also learn it. But they're learning it purely as an intellectual sharpening tool, in no way to try to attain closeness with the lawgiver of it, but merely just to try to chop a clever idea. Right, that won't get you to intellectualism in and of itself isn't gonna make you there. None of those qualities on their own will make you great in Tyra. You've got to work at it, and you've got to say, I'm willing to be practical. I'm going to put the Tyra into practice. So the main theme for certainly the first few parochim is you've got to be practical. You've got to make the Torah a practical thing. You've got to study it in order to practice it. It's not just a study because it's a lovely study and it's very deep and wonderful and interesting. It's got to be something which turns into something. I remember I was living with someone in Hale Barnes when I was teaching there for 2 years. I was living in Hale Barnes, and he sat down and he wanted to learn a particular topic. And he really needed to learn like 101 basics. And he wanted a very advanced philosophical input. And I said to him, why do you want that? And he goes, well, I've always been interested in that. I said, how is that going to change the way you make coffee on Saturday? Like, if we learn the whole book and you see the truth of it, will that have any practical implication to what you're actually doing in your life? And he quite sheepishly admitted, no, I'm doing this just because, I like studying philosophy, of all philosophy, and I'm just interested in Jewish philosophy. So he said, listen, I'll learn the Jewish philosophy with you, right, which I'll do, but it's got to be with a view for some kind of practicability. Yeah, it's not just you'll see the beauty of the Torah through the philosophy and you'll just think of it, it's just as good as Taoism or something like that. It's got to be done in some kind of, at the back of the idea, how am I going to make myself a better person? And that's a very clear thing from what's going on. Let's have a look at Pasuk Aleph in base. It says, B'ni, notice singular, my son, singular, Im tikach, if you take, notice not they, if you take, Amari, my sayings, mitzvaisai, and my commandments, titzpon itcha, they will keep you. They'll keep, not only will they keep with you, they will keep you. Right? It's a very, I'm assuring you, says Solomon, that if you actually keep the mitzvahs, if you do what the Torah is telling you, they'll protect you. Remember, Uncleus was a famous convert. He was a Greco-Roman general who was the nephew of Titus of Russia. And they sent out, they wanted him back because he was a great commander. And Rome sent out a whole legion to go get him. And when they turned up, he said, where are you from? He goes, we're the royal guard. He says, you stand outside of Caesar's palace? He goes, yes. He goes, look, my God stands outside of mine. And he showed him the mezuzah. And they were very impressed. He goes, come and learn all about the mezuzah. So, fine. So they came in, they started learning that. And they all started learning Tyra. And he was teaching them, Uncleus was teaching them Tyra. And they sent out another one. And he did the same kind of thing. He goes, who are you? And he goes, oh, HaKadosh Baruch Hu protects me. I don't have to protect him. And it was so, in the end, he ended up with a yeshiva of elite Roman soldiers. After three battalions were sent, the Senate said, leave him, we're losing all of our best soldiers to this nutter. He's getting monotheism, forget it, just leave him. Just, one down is better than losing 50, you know what I'm saying? And these are crack soldiers, we don't want to lose our crack soldiers. Interestingly, they were at war with Greece and they lost 32 wars as the Gemara of Vodazara. They're being beaten to a pulp by the Greeks. So they went to the Hashmonai, they went to Mattathiahu, HaMaccabee, they went to the Hashmonai and said, would you join with us to overcome Greece? And they said, we'll make a contract. If you do the contract and you let us keep our Tyra and stuff in Israel, then you're done. They wrote a contract. With the Jews, they completely annihilated the Greeks. The first war they'd won in years, after 32 wars. The only one they won was with the Jews. They welched on every single one of their contractual obligations and then outlawed the learning of Tyra. It led to the destruction of the second base of it. Terrible, terrible, terrible. Terrible, terrible. The Jews wrote, say, Gemara Vodazara, it's called the time of the contract, the Shas Shtoros. There was a time in our where we had to live under the contract that we made with the Romans, that we'd go and help them in war. Notice Egypt had the very same idea. They said, all these Jews being in Egypt, we're at war at the moment with Edom, with Esav, and that's family for them. If they team up with Esav, we're going to be done for. So we've got to think of something to enslave them, to weaken them. Otherwise, they're going to be very because they knew that you put Jews in a military situation, because the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of thing. They could be. That's why Egypt enslaved the Jews to start with, because they were scared they were going to join forces with Edom. So we do see the Romans knew about this idea, and it worked. But they welched on all of their obligations. Interesting. Yeah? Interesting idea, yeah? There's a whole time that we had to live under these Roman contracts. It's talked about Gomorrah and Zora in the first parak. Okay. Did you have a question, yeah. Mrs. Do you have a question?
Sort of. I don't know.
Okay. Okay, well, we can do it at the end, maybe. Okay. Now, the Tyra has chided us, especially the Teuchacha, all the various groups of sinners that we talked about in the first parak. The simpletons, the fools, the late sonnets, the scoffers. And it's now teaching us, it's dealt with. Remember, the first parak in Tehillim was stay away from bad people. That's the first pasuk. That's the first parak, really, the first pasuk. And he's done the first parak about staying away from bad people because they're so dangerous. Right, we've dealt with them. Now let's talk to the good people. This now is approaching, notice, his B'ni starts off with the good guys. Now Solomon is turning his attention to people who are genuine and sincere and they want to get close to Hashem. Now the Torah spoke in the plural, but now only the singular is being used. If you, my son, keep my commandments, why? We have a tradition that the religious will be the minority in the world. The minority of the world's human population will be considered righteous. So that's why he's turning around in the singular, because when you're dealing with people who are truly after righteousness, you're dealing with a mi'at. You're dealing with a smaller number. Now you might turn around and go, why is that good? Look at what Hashem does. He always takes a small amount and sanctifies a large amount with a small amount. Look at Shabbos. It's a 6-to-1 ratio. Shabbos is holy, the 6 weekdays are mundane. True, right? One bit of Kedusha covers a whole. Look about Shemitah. 7 years. You've got 1 year that's holy, 6 years that are mundane. Yovel, right? 49 years that are relatively mundane to Yovel, which is extremely highly. Look at challah. A little blob of dough from the whole thing, and the whole thing becomes okay because you're taking challah. The Omer, the Korban Omer, is a 3 fingers full amount of grain that's offered on the temple to permit all the grain in the world. That's Chodesh and Yoshan, only becomes because of the Korban Omer. How much of the Korban Mincha is given the Korban Omer? The Kohen takes a 3 fingers full. It's a very difficult thing to do. One of the most difficult things they used to do in the temple was a 3 fingers full. He had to take just the right amount, not too much, not too little. Then he used this finger to clean up that side and that finger to clean up that side. And that's exactly the right amount. That gob of dough in his hand, that's what had to be thrown on the temple. The next most difficult service to do was the shechting of the birds. Okay, you had to have a tevisa on a dove. You had to hold its wings back. I once saw a Cohen show me how it's done. And they sharpened their thumbnails, much like a mole sharpens his thumbnails today. They would have to hold the hat all with one hand, hold the head of the bird down. I'm miming the head being held down in between these two fingers, which exposes the back of the neck. Then he uses fingers to slit through the back of the neck. And then they would squeeze the blood on the side of the Mizbeach. And if that wasn't done absolutely perfectly, the whole thing was considered void. So the Kohen literally had to hold a turtle dove like that, pull its neck down, slice it and squeeze it. And then, now that had to be done. Now then they threw the bird on the Mizbeach. Now we know that a bird, when it burns, the smell of burning feathers is disgusting, particularly revolting, burning feathers. Hashem says though, that usually birds are given by poor people who can't afford goats, sheep and cows. And because they're spending so much on a bird, which for them is a lot of money, he says that this is almost as if they're offering their own soul. Now, which is very, very pretty. So he wants that. But if you'd sit there and say, this is disgusting, it stinks. And it did stink. If you sit there plucking out all the feathers of a pigeon, have you ever seen a quail or a pigeon that's been like plucked out and it's ready? It's like about that big. The pigeon's body's about that big. It's not a lot. It's all fluffed up in feather. So if you were to pluck out all the feathers because they stink, you'd end up with a little ball of meat like that, which is going to go on the Mizbech. It looks like that, isn't it? It's pasnish. It's nebuch. It's a little ball of meat there. Like, I give a cat. It's given like a meatball. It's a meatball. Hashem says, to make it look more substantial, throw the bird on the Mizbech. It looks bigger. It's more enjoyable for the man to see as if this is he's given something substantial. I don't want to insult him. He's doing the best he can do. If that's what he can afford, that's what I'm happy to take. But don't sit there and pull it out because it's going to stick. It's going to make it look even more nebuch than it is. Kodesh Baruch Hu says you have to take the hit. It may smell disgusting, but you do that in order to. So what do we learn out? In order not to upset someone and embarrass someone, you take the hit. Even if it's difficult in your nose, as it were, it's hard for you to do that. Just remember, Kodesh Baruch Hu is willing to take the bad smell in order not to upset someone that can't afford better. Interesting idea, right? Okay, look, it could be worth coming. Could be worth coming. You never know. You never know. How do we get this? Oh, right. Now, there's something else I wanted to tell you about something. Oh, yes. The lines on the face.
I didn't want to say.
Sorry. With the brothers, you know, Yosef. Yosef was became Tzfas Paneach, became the viceroy. That he was given a name, Tzfas Paneach, and he looked different. He grew a beard and he got older. When the brothers came in, they didn't recognize him. But if you know what you're doing, you can look at a person's forehead and it reveals very, very much about who they are, what they're doing, whether they're righteous or not righteous. It's called Chochmas Apartzef, and it's not that hard to do.
Yeah, can we
learn it? So it's like this. Yosef knew that his brothers knew Chochmas Apartzef. Now, you should know, he did kind of grasp on his... Dad'll tell on his brothers a bit, I'm sorry, I have to say. He went and told Daddy they're hanging around with a girl because they saw that there was a girl that was putting shoes on their feet. And he felt punished for such holy men to hang around with a young lady. And they were walking with her. They were all walking around this girl. It was a breach of sneers. They didn't tell him that girl was a golem. They had made that girl through Sefer Yetzirah, which was written by Avraham Avinu, which teaches you how to make a golem. They did not want to learn that with Yosef or any other brothers because they felt as if the children of Leah were the Spitz, and Rochel, Bilhah, and Zilpah were second-class citizens, and they don't get to learn mystical elements of Tyre. So they never told him, because they didn't want to embarrass him, that we frankly see that they really should have had that discussion. Then they saw them butchering a cow, and they were eating the cow while it was still shivering. They were butchering the cow while it was still shivering. Jews can start cutting up a cow once it's been shechted, even while there's a nervous reaction. But if you're keeping Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach, a guy has to wait until the animal has completely stopped shaking before the cow can be butchered. So he saw them cutting up a cow while it was still shivering. He says, you're wrong. We don't have the din of Jews yet because we don't have the Torah. And therefore we have to assume that we're Chassidei Umos HaOlam, and we have to wait for the cow to stop shaking. And they said, oh, you're talking rubbish. We are Jews, we're the ultimate Jews, and you're rubbish, you're talking about. And he went and told us, oh, they're eating treif, they're eating treif. Very interesting link between immorality and treifus. There's a link between what you eat and immorality. Notice, when Yeshaya came to town, he was given a loft room by the ladies of Shunammis, and she said, I didn't see a flaw in his meat or a stain on his bedsheet. There's a big link between immorality and kashrus. Very, very important link. That's a by-the-by point. So these men were clearly studying Sefer Yetzirah, were Kabbalistically inclined, and they could do Chochmas Apartzef. So Yosef knew when they came to Egypt and they saw him, that he would read his forehead and they'd figure out, hold on, you're a tzaddik. Who are you? And the whole plan of getting them to see whether or not they still loved Benjamin or Yai is all going to go to pot because they're going to recognize him. He always pulled a face. So he would walk in and go like that to make sure his head was like that. It's an interesting concept. So Christophe brings it. So he'd always do that. And they come in and go, who are you? And he goes, who am I? Who are you? You're spies. And he goes, no, we're not spies. We're all good boys and stuff like that. He goes, no, you're spies. Now, notice the Torah says, often they would say things which pulled on his heartstrings and get very emotional. He goes, where's your brother? Oh, our brother and our dad's very frail and he loves our brother and we can't bring him here. And he started hearing about his dad's brother and he started getting so emotional, he had to go next door and cry. So he says, the Torah reports that he just said, just a minute, he went next door, cried and put back together. Why? Because he was losing control over his facial features because he was doing this the whole time. Then he heard about dad and his brother Benjamin and stuff like that and he was like, oh, then he was going to lose it, they're going to see his face, they're going to be able to read his face and there was Yosef. So he had to run next door. He had to
recognize him because his beard.
No, it's not just the beard, it's not the beard, it's the forehead. Everyone says the forehead. The beard was just the first thing. That's, yeah, but it's the forehead. Everyone says the medrash is the forehead. So he had to go outside, wash his face, get himself together, go, then pull off his chilly face and come back out again. And go, he wasn't covering his forehead. That would be very suspicious. That'd be extremely suspicious. So by the way, when Yosef tried to kill, Yehuda tried to kill Yosef, he unsheathed his sword. And as he pulled out the sword, it wouldn't come out of his sheath. And he had a tradition that if that happened, the person you're pulling out the sword with is always a tzaddik. Yeah. So he started to go, he was going to do it, Pasha Zvigash, he was pulling it out, he's going, I'm going to kill you right now. As he did it, he was like, So it was like, something is up with this guy here. So there were some on him, but Yosef wanted to keep it going as long as possible to make a tikkun for the brothers so that hopefully they wouldn't have to get punished. Unfortunately, he never said the words, I forgive you. And because of that, we had to have the 10 martyrs. Wow. Okay, that each martyr atoned for one of the people that was involved in the Mechiras Yosef. If someone wrongs you, even if you don't say it to their face, go out in your garden and say, I forgive this person. Because even if he tried to make up, and he really, really tried to make up, but he never said outright, Mechalach, I said, I've never said, I forgive you. And because of that, that was held against them. Very, very intense. Anyway,
that... it was the eyes of a person.
No, the eyes... No. It's a different thing. It's the structure of the face. Also, we know out that there's 13 points where the beard grows from. Each one is one of the Yud Gimel Midas Rachamim. Hashem, Hashem, Kel, Racham, Vachonon, Erech, Abayim, Vachav, Chesed, etc. Which is why an individual that can't grow a full beard can't be a Dayan, even if he knows all the knowledge. If he passes the exams, if he physically can't grow a full beard, there's something... No, he had his beard pulled out by the Nazis.
Yeah.
He could become a Dayan. If the Nazis come and pull out a beard, that's nothing to do. If an individual has some kind of genetic, where they literally have a smooth face, or they only have a clump of hair there or there, they can't grow a full beard, there's some pagum in there, you give them a Midas Rachman, and you need that to be able to be an effective Dayan. So being able to grow, even if a guy, I don't know what Dayan would shave, but let's say one shave. If he can grow a full beard and he has the knowledge, so good. But some people simply can't. I know a man in Eretz Yisrael, he can't grow a beard at all. He's got a slight moustache, but there's simply no cells or follicles that have hair at all there at all. It looks as if he's smoothly shaven, but he isn't. Even with that data, he shouldn't become a Dayan. Because there's a concept of these 13 points, and you can read which points.
He shouldn't become a Dayan.
He can't become a Dayan if he can do that, right. Because of these concepts, right? I'm not talking about someone that shaves and can grow a beard. I'm talking about someone that actually doesn't have the physical ability to do that. We realise there's something wrong with these Yud Gimel Midas Rachamim coming out. And we need a judge to also be quite merciful, right? It's a very interesting idea. So it's a very secret idea as to why a woman shouldn't become a Dayan. Oh, I shouldn't have touched on that. Okay, anyway. All right, we got 10 minutes. Let's do this. All right. Okay. Now, it's like this. An ignoramus who doesn't know how to serve God should really consult a Torah scholar. If anyone's been attending my shiurim on the Shemona Esrei, on the bracha of Mishpat, didn't we daven for Dayanim and Rabbonim? Because without them, we can't know what to do. If someone's going to do tshuva, they're not going to be able to grow in their tshuva without asking a rav what to do. So you've got to be able to attend or hear from someone that's not an ignoramus. That's why it says, my son, if you take my sayings, that means if you take my sayings from the way that I'm going to transmit them, you have to attach yourself to transmitters of Torah. Let's look at base. L'hakshiv l'chochma oznecha, to have ear to pay attention to wisdom. Tateh libcha l'tavuna. Now this is the first time he's used the word tavuna. Now this is a very important word. Turn your heart to discernment. There's a difference between wisdom and discernment. We've got to discuss this. Now, even if your ears are unaccustomed to learning, you don't go and listen to any shiurim. You should have your ear pay attention. Don't think it's pointless to be taught by others if you can't understand anything on your own. And don't be overwhelmed by the Torah's vastness, thinking it's impossible to learn. Even if you only pay attention to teachers, you're still going to get something. I remember there was a young man that walked into a Beis Medrash for the first time. And it was amazing to see. It's the first time he's ever walked back. It was one of those bottom midrashim, wall-to-wall forum, you know what I mean? And he walked in, he was told, you go there and you'll learn something. So obviously, what do you think? It's like, you know, you pick a book. So he walked in and he saw about 42,000 forum, right, like that. And he was like, looking around. So a guy said, someone ran up to him and said, don't be overwhelmed by the vastness of the written material. Like the Creator, the amount of written material is infinite. It says the fool's heart turns to his left, the wise's heart turns to his right. That's when you've got an open book. In Hebrew, the stuff you have done is on your right, while the stuff you haven't done is on your left. I'm a guitarist, right? So someone I know, they gave up guitar. I spoke to them, I said, why did you give up guitar? He goes, I once saw Andre Segovia play. Once I saw that, I realised there's no point. There's no point. What's the point? That's a fool. A fool will turn around and say, all the pages I haven't learned are impossible to learn. So you know what? Why learn? Why approach that which is unobtainable? That's a foolish way of thinking. A wise person's heart inclines towards the right, i.e. the pages he has learnt. Rejoice in the little Torah you have got and revel in that, rather than thinking, well, there's 20 million other pages I've got to learn, I'm never going to get that, so why should I do it? Don't be a fool. At least get something. Don't say, well, I'm never going to be able to finish that, I'm never going to be able to complete that, so what's the point of even starting? That's silly. Just learn what you can. Turn your ear to wisdom. If you do that, your heart will be pulled towards the idea of discernment. You'll get there in the end. Ki im labina sikra, letavuna titein kailecha. If you call to understanding, you'll raise your voice to discernment. What does that mean? Understanding, bina, is what you extract from wisdom. This is really important. If you understand the idea of heat, and you understand the idea of evaporation, and you understand the idea of boiling points, these are all axioms that you have in your mind. But Bina says, let's invent a kettle. Practical. Notice women have a Bina Yisera. Very practical about it. Get on with it. So you come out with, you go to university and you learn about the idea of heat and it boils up the atoms and the atoms evaporate off the liquid. These are all ideas. That's chokhmah. That's raw wisdom. Bina comes along and says, let's use it. Let's put water in a kettle with the heat and I can make myself a cup of tea. I'm saying, look at that. The wisdom has been practically manifested as a form of understanding. So chokhmah is the raw axiom, and you can notice that through everything you learn in Torah. When it says chokhmah, it's raw data of wisdom. Bina is the application of an understanding of how to use that wisdom. Bina is a depth of understanding, saying, now that I understand that chokhmah, let's get it on, let's get this going, let's use this as some kind of tool. Now, you can never have Bina without Chochmah, because you've got nothing to work with. But Chochmah without Bina stays on the intellectual sphere only. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm saying? You've got to learn it, and you've got to practice it. Practicing is Bina, learning it is Chochmah. But you can never have true Bina without the Chochmah behind it. How can you have understanding of something you don't understand the axioms of? The axioms of the chokhmah, the concepts, you've got to practically manifest that. That's why it's so important to put Torah into actual action, right? Let's look at Dalet. Okay. If you seek it, kekesef, like one that seeks silver.
I was going to say, we didn't give up.
Oh, did we not do Gimel? Sorry, let's do Gimel. Ki im labina tikra, letanuva titain kolecha. I think I just did this. I just did that. That's what I just did, right? That was the idea of look, it says, ki im labina, if you call out to bina, letanuva, you'll get the discernment. But there's no bina without chokhmah. Okay? If you seek it in Dalet as one seeks silver, and you search for it like a hidden treasure, notice, the Torah won't pop out from behind a rock and jump at you and go, look, I'm Torah, I'm clever. All real Torah that you've ever learned in your life had to be worked for. You had to delve into it, you had to open a safe, you had to think about it, read with the Mefushim, you had to ask someone, think about it. You have to find, it's a hidden treasure. Hashem's buried the Torah in the concepts behind the words. You know, you're not going to be able to find it. Oz, then, Tovin Yiras Hashem. Then you'll understand, Tovin, you'll have discernment in what fear of God really means. The truth is, there's no real fear of God unless you've done this. V'das Elokim Timtzo. And you'll find the knowledge of God. Notice in the beginning, you'll have understanding of Yerushalayim. And then you'll know God. You'll find God. Now that's a very interesting idea. Chazal teach us in Gemara Brochos Daf Chof Ches Omad Beis, that's 28b, that if a person finds that they can't fully appreciate Torah study, divine service, and the fear of God, there's no way they're going to get it until they evaluate it in a worldly term. You can't take a spiritual concept that's beyond and divine and beyond, unless you bring it down into something practical. And it says that in a very interesting Gemara, this bracha in Gemara bracha stuff, 28b, says Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, a tremendous scholar, was on his deathbed. And there was a thing, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu gave brachas, vasosa bracha, on the day of his death. We learn out the best time to get a bracha from a tzaddik is as they're leaving this world. Because they're literally one foot in this world, one foot in the next. They can breach, as it were, both sides. And they're so mainly spiritual the bracha is considered particularly efficacious, which is why Moshe Rabbeinu could have given these brachas earlier, but he waited until that moment so that the bracha could stick to Klal Yisrael, the Vezoisa bracha. Why Vezoisa bracha? Because the Vav is connecting to Parshas Vayechi. Yaakov blessed his children on his deathbed, and Moshe blessed the entire Knesset Yisrael on his deathbed, as it were, as he's about to die, Hanivo, right? So this is, so it's a tremendous thing to get up and say, what did Yochanan ben Zakkai do? Of course, he's a massive tzaddik, and he realizes, now's the best time to give my Talmidim a bracha. Just like Yaakov Avinu, and just like Moshe Rabbeinu, now's the time to give a bracha. It's the best time to get a bracha from a tzaddik, right? What was his bracha? What was the bracha to his Talmidim? Says the Gemara in Brachos, oh, it could be a forthcoming moment, you never know, but the Pagiot might be better, I'm not sure, because there could be Pagiot in the fridge, and we like Pagiot, but this might be worth it. He said, may it be Hashem's will that the fear of heaven should be upon you like the fear of flesh and blood. May you fear Hashem like you fear the HMRC. Mm. That seems like a very difficult bracha to give massive tzaddikim who were Talmidim of one of the greatest men of the generation. We're talking lions. They were all lions in their own right, these Talmidim. You turn around to them and say, you should fear God like you fear the HMRC. Who are you talking to? Do you know what I mean? Is that really the right thing to say? It's like this. Here's what we're learning out. The Gemara explains as follows. You may feel as if you're very God-fearing, but if you contemplate the embarrassment you would feel if someone, especially a king or a minister, a very high up person, witnessed you sinning, and you realize that you would probably not sin in front of them, yet you sin in front of God, you've got to conclude that your fear of humans watching you do something bad is higher than your fear of Hashem watching you do something bad. Which means deep down, you're more scared of being embarrassed in front of people than you are in front of God. And Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai said, this is the way it has to go. You have to bring it into human terms. It's a similar idea, by the way. Rabbi Kiva used to get up and study at midnight, like David HaMelech. Oh, it's interesting, both of them, they're so interesting, because both of them made a statement. David HaMelech used to get up in the middle of the night, and he used to write down, that's why Tikkun Chatzos happened. Tikkun Chatzos, David HaMelech, if you remember from Derech Hashem, he introduced the idea of Tikkun Chatzos, because he got up in the middle of the night. And one day he got up in the middle of the night, you remember the whole thing with the harp, he had a harp, which and it was Yaakov's voice that he heard, and that's what he wrote in, and that's what Yaakov wrote all the Tehillim, and he just copied it down, we learned that from the Medrash, so Yaakov Avinu actually wrote Tehillim. So he got up in the middle of the night, and he boasted to Hashem, who do you have like me that gets up in the middle of the night to praise you? Come on, I'm not bad. You know what I mean? So he said that, and he meant it. He was like, come on, it's pretty cool. Who does this? I don't even sleep a full night. Every night I get up to praise you. So as he said that, he was by his window, and he was looking out at the stars, and a bloop, 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 and a frog just sat on his window and go, burr, burr. Kodesh Baruch Hu saying, he sits up all night praising me. Because when the animals make these noises, they're davening to Kodesh Baruch Hu. We learn that from Perek Shira. Because I got the frogs at night, all night, to praise me. Don't think you're... It's davening to Melech, okay. But don't think you're... it's all very nice, you're doing Aus Bechira, but don't think I need your praise. I've got the whole universe praising me. You're doing this to help out yourself. Rabbi Kiva woke up in the middle of the night, used to study as well. At midnight, used to get up and study. And he started thinking of himself... He started pondering, I think I'm pretty great. I'm pretty great. I'm getting up in the middle of the night to learn. And so he was learning. And he looked out of his window. Oh, that's an amazing story in the Gemara. He looked out of his window and he saw laborers that were busy gathering straw and bundling it up in the middle of the night to make sure that by the first thing the next morning, when people needed the straw at 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning, there was always, people that do fishmongers and stuff. The fishmongers that are up, you know what time they're picking up the fish from that? They have to drive all the way to the port to get the best fish. 3-4 o'clock in the morning to go to the, by the time it's 6-7 o'clock, they're setting it all out. You get there at 9 o'clock in the morning, you want a slice of salmon. They've been at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's not so posher. So Pakiva felt as if, I thought I was doing something really special. But these laborers are also up in the middle of the night. It just happens to be I'm blessed that what I'm getting up for is Tyra. But at the end of the day, we're both getting up in the middle of the night. Don't, you know what I'm saying? Put it into worldly terms. Like, realize that you're toiling for something. Everyone's going to be toiling at something. Your question is, what are you going to be toiling in? You know what I'm saying? What value are you going to be putting your toil on? The last minute, we'll do one more pasuk. Pasuk Vav, you've got to use our minutes, right? Because it's 59 minutes in. Ki Hashem yitein chokhmah. Look at this, very important. For Hashem, UK Vovke, will grant you wisdom, which means if you've earned the right to wisdom, Hashem will pour his wisdom on you. It's not an automatic inheritance. The Torah is not an automatic inheritance. Mepiv das usvuna. From his mouth come knowledge and discernment. Now, how can Solomon say that God will grant you wisdom, which seems to indicate that he'll only give it to those who deserve it? That's not fair. Wisdom and intelligence are not subject to free will, but it's a divine decree. There's a Gemara in Nida 16b that says when a droplet comes upstairs, there's a particular, and a neshama's got to be associated with it at the time of conception. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives it all of its midas at that particular time. Is it going to be intelligent? Is it going to be simple? That's a genetic outcome. Some people are genetically propensity to high intelligence. Some are genetically propensity to high intelligence. How can you say, oh, I'll give you my wisdom? The answer is like this, very important idea. God indeed does grant wisdom only to the deserving. But the decree which comes from his mouth concerning the child's destiny doesn't refer to wisdom, but to the knowledge and discernment. Mepiv das usvuna. From his mouth come how much knowledge and discernment you're going to be able to have in your life. How perceptive a person you're going to be. Some people are born more perceptive than others. That indeed is set genetically at birth. Beki Hashem yitein chokhmah. Every person still decides whether to channel their intelligence to Torah. How much potential you're going to work on is completely down to you, and based upon the work that you do in your potential, Hashem will give it to you. Well, I think I told you this when we did Hashem. You know, someone's born under the sign of Mars, he's going to have a bloodlust. I told you about my neighbor who's a sheikhet, and he was doing a live demonstration with his hands in the viscera of the chicken, and he held up his hands and he was like, he loved it. He loved gleaming viscera on his hands. It's something so cool. So cool. Look at that. Look at the liver and the... Oh, look at that. And everyone's like, that's really disgusting. We're going to eat that. You know what I mean? Now, it depends on who... Now, here's the deal. If someone's born with a desire for bloodlust, a Rosha becomes a murderer. A Beinoni, someone in the middle, becomes a butcher or a surgeon. And a Tzaddik becomes a moil. There's no getting out of what a Kodesh Baruch Hu set you up with in your internal makeup. But how you channel that is 100% down to you. If you've channeled what little you can into Tyra, you will get wisdom. Did I tell you about that guy that I met? I think I told you, a very simple guy who always used to ask silly questions in shir. Then I met him a couple of years later at a wedding. I told you that. It's my story, personal story, personal story. Okay, we're under the personal story. It's anecdotal because it's me. I know the person because it's me. This didn't happen to someone else and I read it. And that's such a cool idea and I heard it. This happened to me. So in yeshiva, you learn two levels. We do Be'ian, which is in-depth analysis, really, really in-depth. Then you do Bekias. And Bekias is ground coverage, to get like more of an encyclopedic knowledge. You don't go deep in your learning, you just kind of run through the pages to get the ideas. So it's usually what you did, Be'il in the morning, which is the really tough stuff, you argue on every word. Then Bekias in the afternoon, cover 1, 2, 3 pages. We might cover like 4, 5 lines in a week in Be'il, but we'd cover a couple of pages a day in Bekias. Just to read, you know what I'm saying? Right, so I was in Bekias share, and this guy was in Bekias share with me. And it was a large share. The rabbi was going through the page, going quite quickly, because we're trying to go, no massive questions, just to understand the general concepts, as long as you got the concepts. And he would ask the most stupid questions you've ever heard. He's just off the mark all the time. It wasn't once, it wasn't twice, it was daily. Okay, it was daily. He would ask the most stupid questions, the most inappropriate questions. And he was very, very slow at it. Okay, b'fakasha. One thing led to another. I left that shir, went to another shir, went to Kailal, stuff like that. Lost touch with him. He was a guy in a shir, so I didn't have to keep touch with him. Lost touch with him. A couple of years later, I bumped into him at a co-friend's chasna. Guy got married, and he was invited, and I was invited. So I hadn't seen him in a couple of years. I was like, how are you? And he says, yeah, I'm doing great, yeah. So I said, yeah, where are you at? And he says, I'm in this co-. I said, oh, it's quite a prestigious shiva. I was like, okay, I didn't say anything. I was like, fine, wow. And he said, so what are you learning? He goes, well, I just finished Kasubas. Now, Kasubas is really, 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 really hard. It's like not an easy Gemara. It's really hard. And he covered, it's big, and it's tough, and it's hard, yeah? And he finished it. And I was like, so I asked again, I was very polite, and I said, Do you finish all of Cassibus? He says, yeah, I made a siyum on Cassibus. So I said, well, I learnt for Asman Cassibus. I was like, this stuff's really hard. And I said, well, you did the whole thing. And he said, yes. And I said, do you feel as if you know it well? So he said, yes. I was like, oh. So I said, it took me 2 years. Every day, every afternoon, and all night. And I've mastered the Masechta. Zitzfleisch. So you call it in Yiddish. Zitzfleisch literally translates as sitting flesh. Literally, he sat down and he plugged away. Now, this is an individual who literally would ask in the middle of why bananas yellow. You know, I have no reason. Why are you asking that? It's a stupid question. Okay, people would look at it and go, oh, there, here we go. You know, don't listen to the question. Go like this. It's going to be, you know, what a goat's fall out. Why did the squirrel do that? We're not talking about squirrel. He would do that, right? He would do that. He mastered a very, very, I have not mastered the Masechta. He mastered the Masechta cover to cover with a Mefarshim. Why? He worked at it. It isn't about raw intelligence. It's about plugging away. If you plug away with sincerity, irrelevant of who you are, Hashem gives you his Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu learned 40 days and 40 nights on the mountain. Couldn't get it. But he tried his hardest. Hashem says, I've seen you tried your hardest. I'm going to upload the entire Torah as a gift into your head. You've got to do it. If you put in Me'achos, you put in 100%, I'm going to give it to you. Now, he saw that Moshe Rabbeinu literally strived with every single fibre of his being to understand it. But he said at the end, oh, I don't get that. He goes, okay, I'm going to give it to you. That's not fair. I'm going to give it to you. It is fair because you work for it. Torah is unusual. If you work at it, doesn't matter who you are, what your background is, what your intellectual capacity is, you can get it. All you have to do is sincerely work at it. I've seen it myself with this guy. This guy is not the finished Kasubas guy. But he did. And I was blown away. I was very knocked back. Because, you know, there were kind of like levels in the shin. And he, you know, it just felt as if... And it was like, who's this guy? Oh, he stuck it out. You stick it out, you get. The survivors in Torah Judaism are the long-termers. You can get people that, like, you know, go for it and they're really, really intense for a few months or even a few years. But the Torah is the long haul. One of my rabbonim said to me, we're living in a generation with a one-button press for the microwave, for the photocopier, for the email, for uploading something directly from your phone to Facebook or whatever it is. Everything's one button. It's the antithesis. It's anti-Torah because Torah is long haul, hard work with everything. Everything's halachos to learn and things to do, and it takes years. And we don't live in a world where we care about taking years. Remember Rabbi Tatz once said, if you work in computers, you should get yourself an allotment. Because everyone in computers wants everything to run super fast. But I got news for you. Did I tell you when I called up to take my kids strawberry picking? I called up. I told you that I called up. I said, can I do that? So she was like a woman who must have been thinking, what is this nutter calling me to? She said, yeah, you can come in late July, August. Why are you calling me now in September? You're going to have to wait a year until the strawberries grow. I don't know if you realise this, but there's a sun and a moon and things like seasons and the fruit. Because I think of strawberries as always in a punnet in Tesco's. Yeah. Right? They're always in a punnet in Tesco's. That's who you want strawberries. You might make a strawberry cake. It's right. Over here, you have to wait. Get yourself an oven. You have to wait. It takes time. Torah takes time. Right? You work at it, guaranteed success. Yeah, but I'm dim. Mepiv Das Asfuna, when you said when I was conceived, I've only got like IQ of 28. You can become the God of the door. How can I be the God of the door? Because you worked at it. You work at it, you'll get it. You put in 100% of your effort, whatever that is, I'm going to give it to you. That's why it says, Ki Hashem Yitain Chochmah. I give over Chochmah. You got your Tfuna and your Das from birth. That was genetics. You inherited that from your parents, right? I'm the one that gives over Chochmah. You show me you're worthy of it, I'll pour it into your head. That's how Torah and all mitzvahs work. You want to be good at mitzvahs? Start working at it. You get better at it. Amazing, no? Come on, could be worth coming. Thank you so,